welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined this week by Joe Kirk and Phil Brining. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So this week's session is Roper Roundup Part 2, the ultimate roundup, I suppose, where we carried on from our previous discussion on, you know, what is a Roper, why is it important, how do you use them, compared to privacy notices and information asset registers. And we took that conversation further and we spoke about risk registers, information management software. We covered some ground, to be fair. What were your highlights?
I think for me, the discussion around, you know, the challenges of embedding, you know, data protection in general in the culture of an organization, and as a kind of a extension of that, you know, the notion of process owners responsible for maintaining ROPAs, the requirement to keep the compliance team aware of changes in processing activity. I think that was a highlight for me because, you know, there's some really good ideas about how to do it, but I'm not sure if I'm speaking out of turn. If I am, then edit it out, Miles. I'm not sure we saw a silver bullet, like this is how to fix culture.
Agree. I still got questions on
that. Starting point, really, doesn't it? And every organization's got a different starting point with culture, so face different challenges, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's harder to implement it when it's a bigger organization, and the organization's been going on for such, you know, if it's an organization that's been around for years, it's quite difficult, isn't it, to start to change culture. Whereas if it's a new organization that's, you know, not got many staff, I feel like it's probably a little bit easier to implement behavior changes across the board as opposed to thousands.
Yeah. The other highlight for me was, I think you made a fantastic point, Joe, about the kind of incremental process. You know, that ROPAs is it's an incremental thing. You know, you might do a big exercise to start with, but, you know, is it right? Has it changed? You know, what's the next level of detail you need? And that's how we got on to talking about risk registers on ROPAs, wasn't it? That the fact is it's not a one-off activity, and, you know, if there's a chance that your Roper is going to drift from reality, and how are you going to make sure it doesn't?
Yeah, I think the concept of a risk register is something that I don't often see, and it's not something that I'd really considered until this year. Then I worked with one of our customers who actually requested us to kind of, you know, once it's completed, then what, you know, what does it mean? What are the things in there that cause risk to the organization, to the data subject? Jasmine, was there one more I think you mentioned? I can't remember. But it's it's, I don't think it's something that people consider, and it's the wider thing of, okay, you know, building a rope is one thing, but then going beyond that and actually looking at the contents in there and going through the principles and looking at the things that you collect, you know, is it necessary? Is the retention period appropriate? Is the lawful basis the correct one? If you're relying on legitimate interest, are you carrying out legitimate interest assessments and so on? And I think it just makes you think a little bit deeper on, you know, specific process activities, and it allows you to fully understand what's going on within an organization. And I think it helps you meet other areas of your legal obligations under UK data protection law.
Yeah, I enjoyed that part of the conversation, you know, even identifying to what level of risk do you go to, and at what stage do you start recording risks? Is it as you're completing the ROPA, are you recording the gaps that you don't have the answers to yet? Or is it following the completion of the ROPA when you think you've got everything there? Then is it identifying, you know, what needs further focus, what might need reviewing? And essentially, you know, all of these can be risks, and they need attention in some way or another. But it's just an interesting concept to apply to ROPAs, because, as you say, you know, it's not really something that's commonly done. But yeah, I mean, aside from this conversation, we'll let you get into the main part of the session where we uncover it further, and we hope you enjoy. There's never enough to cover, so we thought we'd come back for more. This session is recorded, so if you've got any problems, there is a privacy notice on screen. But yeah, without further ado, let's get started. So do you remember what we covered last time? Oh no, actually, let's start with
news.
The news. Sorry.
Jumping the gun.
In the news?
I've not seen anything in the news, but I do have a bit of a, not really a story, but something happened to me, I guess. I don't know what you'd call it. But anyway, but when I was on annual leave, I had to go and change some euros before I went away. So I decided to go John Lewis because it had the best rates. And as I was going up the escalator to go to the exchange bureau, I noticed that they had like a screen in front of me that was recording me coming up the escalator as I was coming up. And as I looked up directly at the screen, a blue box appeared around my face. And I was thinking, is that facial recognition? I suspect it was. And I thought, okay, fair enough. There was no signs around the screen itself saying that they were using facial recognition. And it just made me ponder, you know, why were they doing it? You know, I guess, does that class a special category data if they're using facial recognition? I guess it depends on the purpose of why.
Yeah, it depends by why they're doing it. But it might not be facial recognition. I mean, it might be image enhancement, for instance, like this image needs enhancement type of thing. So
I guess so. Maybe I was clutching at straws, perhaps. But
no, but it could well be. They are signed up to the Face Watch scheme, our John Lewis, so they are doing part of that scheme. I don't know if they are in the Leeds store. It's a big store in Leeds, isn't it?
It is a big store, yeah. So it came as a bit of a surprise. It was on every escalator. But when I moved my face, if it was my face wasn't like straight ahead to the footage, then it didn't really pick my face up. So I don't know if that has any sort of, sway on whether it was facial recognition or not. I mean, Jasmine, I mentioned it to you and you had a look at the privacy policy, didn't you? And you said that they don't use facial recognition, and I think Phil, you had a look and it said the same.
Actually, yeah.
It says, I've got it up on the screen here. It said that in store they're using CCTV, they're watching live images. They said we do not use our CCTV systems do not use facial recognition, nor do they collect biometrics. They're also not connected to other systems containing personal data, according to their privacy policy on their website. Lawrence is saying that they have this preset list of offenders, which is what Face Watchers think. But there have been news stories we talked about on here about people being incorrectly identified as being somebody on the Face Watch database. But it kind of reminds me, reminiscent of, you probably don't remember, but I'd have thought 15 years ago, the ICO had a real big issue with the building industry having a blacklist of tradespeople that the building firms said, this person is troubled, don't employ them. And that was kind of prevalent amongst all the building companies. And they said, this is not, it's not fair, it's not lawful, you've got to stop doing it. I'm just wondering what's different between that kind of approach and this kind of face recognition on FaceWatch. I suppose that they're just alerting the store to the fact that there is a known alleged offender.
Yeah.
And therefore maybe they can monitor them. They're not stopping them coming in.
Yeah, and maybe just because that's to prevent and detect unlawful acts, isn't it? Whereas opposed the building site processing is more around just
troublesome.
Tradespeople, and just wants to avoid employing.
Troublesome being asking for troublesome being things like asking to be paid on time and stuff like that.
Not a break from work rather than just 10 minutes to have a sandwich.
Exactly, not properly troublesome.
Maybe more than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Facial recognition, have you seen what Keir Starmer said about widening the deployment of facial recognition across the UK? It's off the back of the disorder, I suppose, after the Southport attack last week, which, it's been a nightmare, really, for the locals in that area since, really. But the Open Rights Group has commented on this, saying that, it's alarming to pledge to roll out facial recognition in a response to the recent disorder. There's still no, lawful basis that could apply to that. And they've got concerns on it.
Yeah, not surprised. It's been centuries of disorder, haven't they? In the summer, it often occurs. People get hot and, whatever. And it all kicks off with riots in many cities over the decades, as far as I can recall.
Over the past couple months.
It's been a little bit crazy.
Well, it's mental.
Yeah. I mean, that bus in Leeds is set on fire as well. That was...
There was the bus and a couple of police cars as well, I think. It all kicked off there a couple of weeks ago. So, it doesn't help the case against facial recognition technology, and I think it's a trajectory that it looks like we're going to be going in regardless.
Yeah.
I could either mention
recent legislation to allow it. But
yeah, well, the savvy perpetrators wear balaclavas or masks, don't they?
Yeah, so at that point then it just completely null and voids the even notion of using facial recognition, because it won't work, will it?
Except on the Hare Hills riots in Leeds, there were videos of people literally with lighters setting a light to that bus. There's just absolute stupidity there as well, you know, to catch yourself
Madness.
Out.
Madness,
yeah.
But
don't need facial recognition for that, I suppose.
And I guess the one good thing about kind of social media and phone usage this day and age is that often these sort of things are caught, aren't they, by not just facial recognition and CCTV, but people who are actually there recording to put them online themselves. Because I actually saw a video of the person who set the bus on fire. Someone identified it was the person that was in the crowd with them themselves. So it's just, right. You know, not just facial recognition that could potentially catch people, but, you know, people who are actually there themselves.
Did you see that Brazilian, I think it's a swimmer, 200-meter swimmer, who's been sent home from the Olympics because she went out for the night, snuck out of the Olympic Park, went out with her boyfriend into Paris, and she put pictures of it on social media. Why would you do that? Anyway, the Olympic Brazilian Olympic Committee banned that and sent her home. Be careful what you post.
Yeah.
Michael
said
to be careful.
Maybe they will ask the CCTV owner to delete their images under the rights of erasure.
What about the presenter that made a comment about women or something and got sacked from the Olympics the other day?
I don't remember seeing that.
Yeah, he said something about typical women or something. And
oh,
next
really?
Thing you know, he got sacked. He was a presenter at the poolside, been there for absolutely years.
Right.
And he got fired straight away.
Right.
People need to watch what they say, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You think you'd know better, really, wouldn't you?
You'd have thought so, yeah.
Well, no.
Now, I don't know if you saw in the news that the papers are reporting that why you put it in the news, I don't know. But anyway, the UK is desperately exposed to cyber threats and pandemics, says the new Minister for UK Science Secretary. And he's basically said that the Conservative government have failed to invest in critical national infrastructure. There's massive, you know, exposure and problems there. And in fact, the ICO has kind of referred to this because the online security lapses that led to the 40 million people's, you know, voters information being hacked two years ago. Again, being put down to failing to patch machines, which is being put down to budget constraints. I mean, it's quite surprising, really. Well, I found it quite surprising.
Yeah, indeed. Sorry, Phil. I was just reading the chat. There's a couple of messages going in.
Yeah, well, we'll cover those in a sec. So what the government, Conservative government, blamed this voter hack on Chinese hackers, and they even summoned Beijing's ambassador to the UK to explain what's going on. China denied it all, but what the ICO investigation seems to throw up, it's just poor security patching and password management that's led to the data breach. So probably not Chinese hackers at all, probably, you know, weak systems internally. This is remarkable. It's reported so openly in the press, isn't it? You know, you're in North Korea or Chinese hacking, but thinking, right, all right, game on.
Yeah, you'll see them applying for jobs soon. North Korea.
I mentioned. I don't think you were here last week. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
you were here. Yeah. Exactly. Now, another thing I saw in the news as well was that there's moves to kind of crack down on overseas numbers being presented as UK numbers. Ofcom have got some new rules coming into place, and I was surprised that they weren't already in place. You know, that they were trying to actively block spoof UK landline numbers, but apparently not. It's not a requirement, so they don't do it. But new rules come into effect mean that the telephone carriers are going to have to do that kind of thing. But again, I was surprised that it wasn't something that they prioritised personally. But
yeah, something that you'd expect would be the case already.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of US-related news pieces. I'm not sure if you've seen them. One relating to Meta. So they're to pay a $1.4 billion settlement with Texas over the facial recognition lawsuit. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, so it's to settle allegations of harvesting biometric data without proper consent. It'll be paid over the course of 5 years and is the largest ever obtained from an action brought by a single US state, and is also one of the most substantial penalties imposed on Meta by regulators, second to the $5 billion settlement with the US Federal Trade Commission in 2020, following the Cambridge Analytica privacy scandal. So it looks like the US, you know, they are taking the data protection seriously, which is nice to see, because they've also passed the Kids Online Safety and Privacy Act. I'm not sure if you've seen that as well.
No, I haven't. No.
I've been a bit out of touch.
I'm now reading the chat as well. I'm crikey.
So yeah, I mean, it's following similar suits. Any organizations that fall within what they call COSPA, the bill, its regulatory scope, must take steps to prevent and mitigate against a number of harms, including mental health disorders such as anxiety, depression, etc., patterns of use that could indicate addictive behavior, online or physical bullying, harassment and violence, sexual exploitation and abuse, promotion of drugs and alcohol, and predatory or deceptive marketing practices.
Right, sounds interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, should we make a start on the main part of the session? Before we do move on to that, I want to remind anyone, just in case anyone has missed it over the past few weeks, that we are IAPP approved. So if you're watching this live or through a major streaming channel, then you can claim credits for it. So it's one credit per session. And I'm going to put a link into the chat here. For how you can claim your points. So we finally got one on the website. follow those directions. But yes, anyway, Ropers. So last time, what did we discuss? Let's refresh everybody's memories.
It's a good question, Jasmine. Do you know the answer?
I'll pick it up. So, you know, we spoke about what are Ropers and what are they for? You know, what are the benefits of them? You know, you can use them to write fair privacy notices. It's obviously a legal requirement in itself. It's the core for everything you do as an organization that involves personal data, really. We compared it against information asset registers. What's the difference? Can they, you know, work interchangeably? Can they be combined? I think we compared ROPAs against the requirements of a privacy notice. You know, what's the difference between them? And spoke about a couple of universities who publish their ROPAs, or at least hopefully part of the ROPAs, because they were quite sparse.
So hopefully not the whole thing. Ground, yeah, really.
Yeah, I hope not. But you know, like we said, there is still a lot to talk about today. So we would like to, you know, or intend to discuss more on, you know, what happens after you've built your ROPA. How do you identify risks? What is the purpose of identifying risks within a ROPA? And so on. So how do you define a risk? Oh. let's start on the risks.
Just a brief aside, Jasmine. It's interesting because I'm, you know, I'm doing quite a bit of work in Jamaica at the moment. And there's no legal requirement to maintain records posting activities because there's quite a comprehensive registration process you've got to go through. But everybody we're working with is wanting to compile records posting activities. That they're kind of seeing that as an essential step in being able to figure out what's going on and understand it and document it in order to fill in the registration particulars. And I find that quite interesting because it's not coming from me saying you need to do this and then people pushing back saying, oh, no, why do we need to do that? And say it in the Data Protection Act. It's coming from the customers saying, right, we need to kind of step through this process. Now, I think it's because GDPR is so, it seems like it's so universally kind of recognized, understood across the world. And people are, you know, are seeing that as a measure and wanting to do it as a means to an end. So I just found that really quite interesting.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, Phil, actually, on that. Do you think that's because those organisations are international and caught by the GDPR and UK GDPR, and they have ROPAs in place already for the processing that they do in the subsequent you know, some territories.
Yeah, yeah, some
and
are.
That's why they then think it's a good idea just to have it across the board.
Yeah, some are. Some are, you know, very small operators, hotel operators, and some, you know, we're working with a stationary supplier. So not massive, you know, an office buying supplier, not massive global organizations. We've got a couple of big orgs down there and a couple of global orgs down there. So it just seems, I don't know if it's just, I don't know, but it's definitely there as a thing.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, I think even if they're not a legal requirement, they are incredibly useful, aren't they? I mean, the DPDI bill was going to take away, wasn't it, the legal requirement of a ROPA. And I think if the DPDI was to come in, I think, you know, my thoughts anyway was to thoroughly encourage organisations to still keep a record of person activities, because they're such a useful bit of kit, and they're a central part, aren't they, of an organisation's data protection infrastructure. Everything comes off of it.
I think they are as well, but I think they don't deny that they're hard to put together and hard to maintain and hard to put a process in to keep them up to date. But I guess that's what we wanted to talk about today, aren't we? You know, tricks of the trade for having to keep on top of them, you know, and update them as things change. Now, if you've got fairly stable processing activities that aren't changing, you know, the purpose for processing probably isn't going to change. The lawful basis for processing isn't going to change. But let's say you change a processor, you know, you need to then go into your ROPA and update it, you know, or you might start some new processing activity. Therefore, you've got to put a new row on your ROPA. You might do something that's a bit complicated and have to strip out some rows in your ROPA. So, you know, it could be that you do have to add new stuff in and change them. But I think getting the business to recognize the importance of it is a real challenge.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry, go on, Jasmine.
So, I was reading the ICO's website yesterday on ROPAs, and they add a step before building a ROPA, and I think this can also apply in maintaining your ROPA in terms of data mapping and data auditing. And that's one thing that I've struggled to get my head around, you know, the benefit of that and how that would look, because to me, visualizing that, it my brain turns to fog. I would rather just go directly to the ROPA and lay out, you know, exactly what you're doing, except maybe in some instances where you can start at the life, you know, at the beginning of a process and activities life cycle. But I just think, depending on how you approach your data audit or data mapping exercise, I think it could get really complicated just based on the number of processing activities and a department can, you know, can do.
Yeah,
obviously, Phil, you love a flow chart, but
I agree with you that visualizing the data processing, you know, complicated data processing is really quite hard. And I'm not sure I'd like the term mapping, although mapping for me means creating a visual reference point or reference materials. But, you know, we know that OneTrust uses the term data mapping just to go through that process of doing the ROPA, doesn't it? And when I first started working with OneTrust a few years ago, I was thinking, what is it actually going to ask me to do, you know, this mapping exercise? And actually all it was doing was just filling in boxes on a form. So it wasn't, I wouldn't have called it a mapping exercise. It was more of a recording of the situation exercise. But it depends what you mean by mapping, I suppose.
I know. I don't think it's clear. I think in one sense you could create a flow chart. In another sense, you could create a questionnaire, and they'd both be seen as that kind of audit exercise. But if you're issuing out a questionnaire to relevant staff, say like staff within a department, and you want them to complete it to be able to then compile a ROPA or update it, why not just go straight to the ROPA? Because if you're leaving that with them, they might not understand all of the answers anyway, or you might not be able to tease the information out, you know, that it might not be sufficient with what provides. So I don't understand how that makes the process, what point in the process that there is really for it.
I mean, Amy's making a really interesting point. So using AI to help compile and maintain ROPAs. Now, it depends what it's actually doing. But when we've been putting together, you know, new ROPAs, so everyone hopefully has got ROPAs in place because we've had this law for 6 years. But in Jamaica, for instance, where we're going through this process, I've moved on from what we used to, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, with a right, here's a blank sheet of paper, let's get everyone together, let's talk through what you do, let's think about your processes, let's think about your systems, and let's write up a ROPA. What I've started to do is I've asked ChatGPT, because it's really good at this kind of stuff, give me a typical ROPA for an IT department, and it comes back with some really quite useful stuff. So I've been putting that type of information. I mean, it doesn't get it all right. It doesn't know about processes, and it doesn't know about transfers, etc. But you can start off with a fairly good. You start with a blank sheet of paper. You're starting off with a partially completed bit of paper, which I found is a lot easier for people in departments to get their head around. So that's kind of a really elementary, simple use of AI to start building a ROPA. And I'm interested to talk it further. Sorry, Giles, you were going to say.
No. I was just going to say, I think it's a really useful tool for guidance. But, you know, to go solely off that is a risk in itself. And I'm not advising that to anybody because it can get it wrong. But, you know, we'll get asked by organisations when they're starting a ROPA, do you have any examples of what one might look like? And that just helps so much. I mean, I remember when I first looked at ROPAs and I was trying to get my head around it to then, you know, obviously be able to advise customers. I was thinking, no idea, like how granular you should go and this and that. And that only comes with experience. But, you know, as an internal person within an organisation, you're not going to come with that all the time. So,
separate it out. Yeah, I found that because everyone understands employment, because in the work context, we're all employees. So the easiest one to rope us to explain to people to get the concept across is using HR. So, you know, we're doing recruitment and selection. Recruitment. This is the type of stuff we're doing. Yeah, we're now in employment. You know, this is what we're doing. We're doing training and development, learning and development. So we're doing.
And you can follow the life cycle of the employees.
People understand that. People understand that. Yeah, we've got grievances now. You know, we've got disciplinaries, we've got exit, we've got references. If you know, I found that, and to be honest, you know, ChatGPT, if you don't have to ask it to come with a ROPA, if you ask it typical processing activities of an IT department, a company secretarial department, a marketing department, it actually does a pretty good job of a starting point. It's not comprehensive, and you can't rely on it, trust it. You know, you've got to use it as a starting point, but it is a good starting point, I found. But I think Amy's going a bit further. Amy is saying that maybe the AI is actually monitoring processing activities. I mean, I'm putting words in her mouth here, but maybe monitoring processing activities in database systems and starting to determine whether they're accurately reflected in the ROPA. I don't know, but I would have thought that if you know, if you can get an AI tool to do that, it'd be pretty useful.
She said that the tool integrates with all the systems and tools and constructs the ROPA.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'd probably, if it's not horrendously expensive, I'd probably give it a trial and set it off. But you'll still need to double check that it's caught everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, you'd still need to go back through with a fine tooth comb, wouldn't you, to go back through and just make sure that everything's accurate. And I guess that comes on to the purpose of this, I guess, around kind of, you know, identifying any inaccuracies, and, you know, anywhere that's incomplete. And as Jasmine says, any risks that could be in the ROPA itself.
But I tell you what, I bet you that.
Go on,
Phil. I was going to say, I tell you what, I bet you that AI is infinitely better than the humans at finding data disclosures, transfers, etc. So there's already a ton of tools out there that are monitoring, you know, like data loss prevention tools that are monitoring outbound traffic, you know, where employees are posting data. You ask somebody where you if you share data with anybody, oh no, we don't share data, you know. But yeah, they're using 4 or 5 different cloud-based systems, and they're disclosing data to processors. AI will get that, and humans, in my experience, don't. So I think in some respects, it will do a much better job at documenting that. Well, the trouble is, you then have like 150 processors to wade through. Whereas if you're in blissful ignorance, because everyone says, oh no, we don't transfer data anywhere, then your ROPA is a lot simpler.
But I guess that's also down the human side of things. No, the human side of things is also down to, you know, lack of training of the people that you're talking to aren't actually aware of, you know, what a recipient is, what a processor is, and they don't understand where the data is going. And I guess that's, I think that's what we always find tricky when we help organizations build ROPAs, is that we kind of got to trust what the people that we're talking to say. And then I know that there's ways that we can kind of try and pry information out, but, you know, there's only so far we can go with that.
Well, first time round, we trust them. And then what we have to do is we have to periodically review it. I still maintain that building ropes is an incremental process. You start off with what you start off with, but you've got to go and check it and test it. And you will do with the AI tool. You need to find, you know, go into the business and find something and say, right, where is this posting activity on the roper? And then you've got to go in the roper and say, well, where is this roper entry in the business? And then, you know, we talk about this all the time, don't we? Then the third aspect, the triangulation effect, is where is it all in the privacy information? Because the process needs to be disclosed to the data subjects. So I think, you know, you're absolutely right, Joe, but you've got to make sure that you've got, you know, proper, decent, critical internal or external review of ropers to get them where they need to be. Now, I'm not sure whether you're best off kind of saying, well, we'll do that on a, let's say, annual basis. And in the meantime, we'll accept that ropers are going to be inaccurate because we're inefficient at keeping up to date. Don't know whether that works. I mean, there's a legal obligation to keep them up to date. Or whether you say, no, every time somebody changes something in the business, you've got to tell us and we've got to update the ropers. Or whether you say there's the ropers for you to maintain up to date. There's different ways of doing it, aren't there? But you've got to keep checking them.
Yes, it's not just the end of the project, is it? Once you've first input the data, it's kind of you go beyond that, don't you? And I guess that's kind of the point of the session. We've not really touched on it, I don't think. I mean, Jasmine, you asked this question, what is risk? And it's a good question, but I think some context as to kind of why you'd be looking at risk. So I've been doing quite a lot of Roper project work this year. And I think I've been working with a customer now for 8 months, give or take, since the start of the year. And I think they came to us, they needed help with the building of the Roper. And I think before that, the only kind of side of the Roper stuff that I did, or, you know, we did at Data Protection People, was the building of the Roper. But it's a lot more than that. Of course, we'd give advice around maintaining it, but I think this customer specifically wanted what we called a risk register. So that kind of involved going back through the Roper and making sure that everything that in there was accurate. So looking at retention periods, looking at the data that they collect and seeing if it's actually necessary to meet the purpose of the processing. And then off the back of that, you know, are there any risks within the processing activities? You know, is it considered high risk? Are they using consent? You know, do the consent forms meet the conditions of consent? Legitimate interest assessment, are legitimate interest assessments being carried out, and so on. And I think that's also critical at the second phase of the Roper project. And I think, Jasmine, you put a good question of, you know, what is risk? And I don't know if I have an answer to that. Phil, are you probably maybe better suited to answer what risk is, or Jasmine?
I think Phil's just talking in the chat, but
yeah, I was just doing it in chat. So to James, we'll cover off systems and Excel sheets in a minute.
Yeah, we did speak about, Kane and I spoke about risk in the DPAA session, but it, you know, it's a complicated concept. There are different ways to look at it. You know, there's different angles to look at it. There's risks to the individual, risks to the organisation, risks of non-compliance, etc. And it's, I think, you know, there's so you're looking at the real life risks or the risks of non-compliance when you're completing a ROPA, or both. And I think you can, regardless of what approach you want to take, you need to set that out beforehand, you know, and make it clear how you're going to define it when you go into it. Because, you know, Joe, you've had experience, haven't you, where you've defined risks as gaps in a ROPA, as that being a risk of non-compliance, whereas then an organization said, no, we'll fill in those gaps and then we'll look at what's remaining and then treat them as risks. But then you could take that, you know, at any stage of the process. You know, you could do all of your projects following it, looking at your DPAAs and third parties, and then, okay, what are the risks after that? And it's you know, it's all part of the process at some point.
I think I'd add on to what you said. I absolutely agree with you, Jasmine. But I mean, every time I say like indefinite in retention periods, I'd see that as a risk. You know, where's the business justification? Mm. I mean, I'd even flag up the use of Excel for maintaining ropers as a risk. You know, most people accept that as a risk. But, you know, it's very hard to get version control on it. It's not that user friendly from a data sharing point of view. You know, if you've got multiple people using it, there's a tendency for it, you know, not to synchronize properly, as we find. Then you end up duplication. It's not really very good for it. I mean, it does, and it's cheap, but it's not that good for it. It depends what you want out of that risk assessment of your ROPA process. But I think I'd be like you, Jasmine, saying, well, I'm going to start off with, you know, the ROPA itself doesn't comply with the requirements. And then I'd be saying, well, the information containing the ROPA has got some compliance risks, like indefinite retention periods. And then I'd be looking at the actual risks around the ROPA itself. You know, how well is it managed? How well is it version controlled? What tools are we using for it? Et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's multiple levels to it, Joe.
But I think they're all.
I agree.
It's not a standard practice, you know, to have a risk register with, you know, alongside a ROPA, but it's a really useful tool to be able
I've very rarely seen it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, tune in
on, you know, your focus areas, which where are the highest risks, where are the biggest gaps in your compliance.
I'd not considered it before, and I think since now I've done the project, I think it's something that I'm always going to do, because it's very useful, and it also kind of allows you to kind of do the next phase of the project as well, in terms of looking out and seeing if you've done DPAs on some of the protein activities. I'm talking now in a sense that this, you know, doing a ROPA as an organization who's been doing these protein activities for, you know, several years, you're relying on legitimate interest, for example, a risk register should highlight, you know, there's a risk here that the individual's rights and freedoms haven't been balanced with the interests of the organization. And I think it paints a really nice picture, and it's a good way to kind of track the progress and just making sure that you've dotted all the I's and crossed the T's in terms of, you know, the other side of the ROPA. Of course, you just hear documenting stuff, but there's more to it than that, right? With a protein activity, often you find there's lots of things, like as Phil, you said, making sure that retention periods are accurate. I think Jasmine, you made a good point, kind of it kind of reminds you to kind of go through the principles, doesn't it?
Yeah, I find that once a ROPA is completed, there are generally, you know, common gaps that you come across. So it could be lawful basis, because people across the organization don't really have that understanding. It could be third parties, including international transfers and data processing and sharing agreements, etc. Could be DPIA, for example. But something I think that, you know, there's so much focus on making sure that the ROPA is accurate, that everything's accurately recorded, that then there's no, you know, nothing's then questioned about the process and activities itself from a data minimization perspective, for example. You know, you don't look at the categories and think, do I really need all of this information per process and activity? And I think that's then another level to, you know, a ROPA review.
Agree.
Yeah. we were writing, again, we're part of the activities that Katarina and I were doing with this new transfer mentioned to South Africa for this client, was to review the ROPA and update the ROPA record. And that was useful part of the business process, is, you know, we're doing something different, and therefore, you know, we've got to check and update the ROPA. But this brings me back to, and I'm just in the process of getting into a system to show a systemized database ROPA. You know, you can't necessarily get the complexity of the information down into Excel, which is one of the weaknesses of it. So if you've got multiple processes, multiple transfers, you know, it needs a lot of annotation to make sure people reading it understand which processor is doing which international transfer and what transfer mechanisms are in place around that. And the same with, you know, any other aspect of it. It's not ideal, but we'll come on to that in a second. You were talking about culture earlier, Joe, as well, about, you know, getting this embedded in the culture and how best to do that. Again, I don't know if people have got some great examples of it, you know, what they've done.
Oh yeah, I would very much like to hear actually the listeners' thoughts, or even, you know, yourself and Jasmine's. I guess that kind of comes from necessarily around maintaining the ROPA. Whose responsibility is it? I mean, we often say, don't we, that you should, and I think the ICOs say the same around process owners, who are people within each department who have a wider oversee of what's actually going on within the organization, and they'll probably be better suited to go into the ROPA and maintain it, and also, you know, speak to the people who actually are doing these things on a day-to-day basis, who are just your general employees. And I think the trickiest thing that I find is, you know, or I've started to see, is how do you get, you know, the people within your organization to buy into what you're doing, to take care and responsibility into, you know, data protection. I think it's something that I struggle with, and I'm not really sure I have an answer, but I don't know if any listeners can weigh in on any tips of how to embed data protection culture internally.
A long process, isn't it? By over time, if you, you know, assign responsibility to whatever you want to call them, process owners or data champions across the organization, you know, get them really bought into, well, either force them into it or get them bought into the idea of data protection and their responsibilities in their respective areas, then over time, you know, they'll start to understand it and will, I don't know, I suppose it's supporting those people as well in how they can, I suppose, enforce data protection responsibilities throughout their departments. You know, it's not a one-man job, really.
No, of course, but how do you buy people into it is what I'm saying. So, you know, it's, do you put it into their job description and start threatening them, saying that, you know, if you don't start doing this as a responsibility, I'm going to fire you? Do you, you know...
That's always a great way to do it.
I'm being very extreme there, of course, but you know, I think that's something that, you know, how do you actually get people to buy into it? Because there's only so much you can do of reminding people that it's your responsibility. But you know, if you don't get, it's a very hard job, and it's everyone's responsibility, isn't it? But how the hell do you remind people of that and get them to buy into it?
It probably has to come from the top down, really. You know, the DPO can only enforce so much responsibility onto other people within the organisation. But if they report to board and say, you know, this is, data protection is everyone's responsibility for starts, but some people need to take on more responsibility to ensure that that is actually the case across the organisation. And then I don't know whether that would be through, you wouldn't call it like a restructure. I don't really know in business terms, but because obviously if somebody signed their employment contract with the job description and it's not included in that, there could be some, you know, some pullback in it. I think that's probably where the tricky part would be. But if you do get people on board and you know, you do assign them this responsibility and they take it, then it's just nurturing that as time goes on. And I suppose improving their understanding of data protection so then they can pass on those learnings to other people within the department, and also then set in place, you know, once a quarter, this is what's happening, we need to review, you need to update me on any new changes and etc., you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, culture is a reflection of behavior, isn't it? That's what it is, and we've got to make sure we're changing people's behavior, and I don't think we do that all with stick, you know, but they have to be seen to be consequences for non-compliance, you know, which is the stick element of it. And I don't know how many places I've been where, you know, there's no consequences for data protection non-compliances or for, you know, breaking the rules. But as soon as that is the case, unfortunately, you know, then it gets treated with less importance, I think. But you talked about getting people to come to us, Joe. We also have to get out to them, you know, we have to be seen, you know, walk the floors, getting amongst them, you know, be nosy, but be supportive, you know. I think it's a tricky thing, and it takes time, I think, to change behaviour. I was on the phone to somebody the other day, and I said, you know, the easy bit is writing down a policy. That's $1. Write a load of words on a paper, and then we distribute it. The really hard thing is getting people to work within whatever we've written down and to check and to nurture and to encourage it. And I think Maria's quite right. You know, it's about reinforcing, you know, the messages we want to get across. And we've got to try and make it fun and engaging. It is actually a fun and engaging topic if you have the right disposition for it. But for most people, there's an automatic switch off, I think, as soon as you mention data protection. Yeah, if you've got your management team, you know, disregarding it, not being sure about it, giving out those, you know, I think, you know, negative perceptions about it, then it'll filter down.
Yeah.
I think.
And we find, you know, when we engage with a customer, it can be one or the other, that either there's total buy-in and, you know, an intention. I don't know if sometimes people just think we're the ICO or what, but, you know, a really eagerness to improve the compliance. And then other times you just know that it's just going to be a battle. Like, I've probably mentioned it on here before, but I remember having a call once, I can't remember what I was covering, whether it was like ROPA or a DPA or something like that, and there were two people on this call, and one just wasn't listening. He had his camera off. He was like, oh, sorry, I was just looking at boats. It's like, why would you even admit that? First of all, it's very rude. You're wasting my time and yours. And also, why would you be too honest for your own good?
Some good things. Good things in the chat. I mean, I'm a great believer in sort of data champions and working parties and, you know, engaging members of the business. Half of it is getting your eyes and ears out there and bringing back to you what's going on. And the second thing is there a mechanism for distributing out the messages you want to distribute out. So they work, I think. I've seen them work really well. And I remember one client I worked with, and the data champions group was dominated by one person. The chief exec sat on it, and it was dysfunctional. It didn't work at all. Everyone was kind of terrified on this forum, so it didn't really work at all. So if you got to think about the terms of reference and the structure of it and who's on it, but they can work remarkably well.
I think languages is a very important thing, because a lot of people don't like things that they can't understand. Obviously, you know, it depends what it's about, and people like to learn more, but that's people's automatic response when it comes to the law a lot of the time. So trying to speak to people in a way that they understand, and even just by showing them that you're trying to work with them, I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, and again, it's something about sharing lessons. Yeah, feedback, you know, is important. You know, you've got KPIs, you know, feedback that the business is doing well, that it's improving, it's getting control of things. I think there's some good stuff. There's a discussion about the cost of these compliance management systems, and I have to say I'm not that familiar with the cost of the systems. I know that some of them at the top end are really expensive, like, you know, 100 grand a year type of expensive. And I don't know about the middle tier and the lower tier systems. I don't know if you've got any experience, you two or anybody else, about the cost of these types of systems.
I've only ever really come across two systems. One's DPO Center and one's OneTrust and one's DP Organizer, and I don't know the cost of either of them. And I know that doesn't really add much to the conversation.
Well, I think OneTrust starts at 60,000 a year, I think. But they also have kind of turned away from the middle market, haven't they? They've only really gone for big organizations.
And it's not just Roper stuff you can do in there either, is it? It's a lot wider than that. So,
well, I think all of the systems, you can do anything you need everything, to do as a DPO. Yeah, managing breaches, rights requests, etc. But I'll only show this just as an example, just so people can get the head around it. So please don't think I'm trying to sell anything here, because that's not my style, as my colleagues know. But I'm going to show you the system that kind of we've built and had around for a while, which, you know, we've built this ourselves because we've got the in-house capability to build it, because it's built on our CRM platform, our Salesforce platform. And we do allow our customers, if they want to use it, you know, to use it. And yeah, there's a fee attached to it. But this is like, it does a lot of things. But the Roper record, you know, you end up with general, hopefully you can do green, general information around the Roper. And of course, you know, with a system, you want to be able to customize the data fields. If you want to add in different checkboxes to personal data, you want to be able to add them in, ideally, so you're tailoring it towards you. So you've got the kind of information around that doesn't, that's kind of relatively static, let's call it. Computer's running like a very slow thing here. But the interesting thing that databases can do that spreadsheets can't do is when you've got, you know, complex relationships. So with a relational database, you've got things related to the Roper record. So anything you put in a field, you know, if you want to change or have multiple of it, then it becomes more difficult. So what you have to have a related record somewhere else. So, for instance, we can link the Roper back to the information asset register. By creating a record in between these two things, the Active Directory, for instance, entry in the IAR and the Roper entry that we've got here. It's machine's running dead slow. But anything that you've got related to a Roper, you know, like a recipients, you know, then from recipients, you've got international transfers. If you've got a Roper related to a DPIA, again, you would record that. You do the DPIA in the DPIA section. But you then link that back to the Roper, and getting that kind of complexity of relationships expressed in a spreadsheet is nigh on impossible. unless you have a really complicated spreadsheet with macros, and then you'd run into all sorts of problems if you've got that. So I'm gonna shut up now. But there are systems around, and some of them, you know, are more user friendly than others. And there's new entrants. I saw one in a few months ago called what was it called? I can't remember. It's a small British company. They set it up. I had a review of it. It needed a bit of polish on it. A lot of systems do, but it did a basic job. And it's really just a question of finding out, you know, what it is you want to do and get the right price point and how it works. And but they are available, and there's quite a few. When we built this back in 2011, there was nothing available. This was the very first kind of data protection governance platform that I could find, which is why I built my own. But then there's lots that have come onto the market since then.
You were sick of trying to find them, were you, Phil? And just thought, if no one else has got it, I'll just do it.
Yeah, I went to see a compliance control center, I think it was called. I went to see quite a lot of people saying, you know, can you do this? No, we can't do that. You know, and so, yeah, we were a Salesforce consulting business at the time. And so I thought, right, sorry, we'll build our own. we need to manage the records. I'm not sure how
can we provide stop demos on that
sharing.
Bill?
Yeah, we can do if you want to have it. I mean, you can have a demo of it just to see what it does to help scope out your own functionality. If the system works for you, great. And if it doesn't work for you, it might help inform you of what you actually want it to do or what to look for. So I'm happy to help the community in that respect. I'm trying to get Teams back so I can stop sharing, but that's it. I found it now. So my screen's all gone haywire.
Glad it's not just me with the issues today.
It's just running slow, really, really slow.
Yeah, I think it's freezing. As long as we can still hear each other, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm trying to stop sharing now, so carry on the conversation.
Joe?
Yeah, thanks, Jasmine. I'm not really sure what direction to take it in, to be fair, after that, Phil. I think Sorry, go on, Jasmine.
No, I was just going to say about that question that you were faced with earlier this week.
Around, remind me.
International employees.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. So yeah, I mean, on Europa, Phil and Jasmine and listeners, when you are working with an organisation that has employees globally, we'll both go with two scenarios: either the organisation's international and they have, you know, people who work in US and Europe, and then there's one that just works in the UK and they've just got employees abroad. If they do separate project activities, would that also need to be included in the ROPA as well? I suspect if it's a UK organisation and the employees are abroad, then of course the answer would be yes, because it's a UK organisation. But if it's international, would it just depend on whether that territory that they're in is caught by, you know, the requirements of needing something of a ROPA, similar to a ROPA? I don't know if I've articulated that very well.
Not sure I follow what you mean. I think what you're saying is, let's say you've got a company based in the UK and they've got an office in, well, let's say South Africa, and that South African office is doing something distinctly different from the company in the UK or the operations in the UK. That office in South Africa, the entity in South Africa, needs to comply with its local laws, the POPIA in South Africa and the RICA, I think it is, for electronic marketing. Whether it is caught by the UK GDPR, I wouldn't have thought so. It's not established in the, you know, if it's a separate business, it's not established in the UK. It's not offering goods and services to the UK. It's not monitoring behaviour in the UK. Probably not caught by UK GDPR. But I don't know. It depends on the nuances of it, the actual details of the situation. But then you might say, as an international business, we want to try and get everyone up to roughly the same level to get us control centrally and over governance. So you might say, well, we wanted to put it onto the rope as irrespective of legal requirement to or not, just to give us some overview and control of it.
Yeah, no, a good idea, actually. I think it probably makes most sense, doesn't it, to probably cover it on there. Like you say, it's, even though they might not be caught by it, I think it would act as a central hub for you to understand, or the, you know, everyone to understand what's actually going on in different territories. So yeah, I will bear that in mind. It's actually a question that I got asked from a customer, so I will definitely consider that. Thanks, Phil.
Yeah. So how are you going to record? So the question relating to ROPAs is, are you going to record that on the ROPA? How are you going to record it? You know, are you going to have a rope per division? Are you going to have a rope of the whole thing? You know, is that going to be like an entry on the roper? How are you going to flag it up? So one of the things that I see as a weakness all the time on ropers is they don't, people put these spreadsheets together and don't put unique references on them. So every row should be roper one, roper two, roper three, roper four. And of course, Excel will do that for you. You can sequentially number things in that kind of format. But if you're relying on the row numbers in Excel, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, et cetera, and you resort your sheet, all the numbers change. So you got, you need to have a unique way of referring to that processing activity, that roper, you know, as a row in the database or on the spreadsheet.
No, that's something I've not considered either, to be fair.
Yeah, and then, you know, if you've got a complex organizational system, I don't like ropers split over multiple sheets in a spreadsheet. I prefer to have, the first thing I do if I get one like that is put it all into one spreadsheet. One, so I can check that it's all consistently columns in the right place. But two, you know, I like to filter stuff and sort stuff and search for stuff, which is more difficult when on multiple sheets. You can't filter on multiple sheets. You can search across multiple sheets, but you can't filter and say, like, give me all the HR department in Zimbabwe, for instance. But you could do if it was all on the one sheet and you had division, department, etc., as variables on that sheet. And of course, another good trick with Excel is using the data validation. So you can restrict the what people could put into the cells according to, you know, values that you want in a list that's somewhere either embedded in that kind of data validation piece in Excel, or you have a data validation sheet and all the valid entries, whether it's yes, no, true, false, you know, consent, contract, the legitimate interest, etc. You have them in the cell and people can only pick those. Which is good to help normalize the data. So Excel does do a good job, I think. But when you're getting, you know, trying to explain, we've got an Excel workbook for everything you need to do. So, you know, if we're setting customers up, we'll say, well, here's the Excel workbook. It's got a processor ROPA, a controller ROPA, a breach record. It's got records of privacy information. It's got training records. It's got rights request records. It's got everything you need to do, you know. I think it's better in a database, but it works well, you know, for small operations on Excel. But you've got to use Excel to its best capabilities, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. If you, on a entry into the ROPA on Excel, and if, say, for example, you wanted to keep a record of whether a DPA has been carried out, rather than just saying like yes or no, it's probably best to put the actual location of where that DPA can be found, because obviously
if possible,
you can't tie it in there.
Well, if possible. I mean, again, this is where Excel starts to fail, because really what you'll know is who did it, when did they do it, what was the outcome, and where is it. That's four extra columns on your spreadsheet. And if you've got that,
yeah,
if you got that for breaches and anything else you're recording on the ROPA, then it just becomes very, very unmanageable very quickly.
Unless you were to actually go into the DPIA itself, but that just slows you down, I guess, doesn't it?
Well, assuming you can, you know, if somebody sends us their ROPA to review, we can't access their SharePoint unless it grants permission to do
point.
So
yeah,
it may work or it may not work, but
and having a system as well, it'd make it much easier to combine or cross-reference an information asset register to a ROPA if that's the approach an organization takes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find with databases is that it's a lot easier to see something on a spreadsheet. You can see the whole thing, and you can, unless it's absolutely enormous, you can actually, you know, get your head around it quite quickly. In a database structure where things are in different places, you know, different records but related to each other, I think that there's a possibility of losing sight of stuff. You have to then run reports on the system to get the data out to be able to make sense of it. So I think Excel sheets do have some merit, quite a lot of merit, but you know, there's other options as well.
Yeah.
In my
almost out of time. That was a very nice roundup. Should we finish there? And
well, what did we say we're going to cover? Have we covered what we said we were going to cover?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. My notes aren't all.
I think so. But we always end up rambling, don't we, and going on to tangents. So I guess that's for the listeners to answer, really, rather than us, as to we've covered everything.
We talked about having a ROPA policy and procedures, you know. And again, I think that the policy should be pretty high level. You know, we are going to maintain ROPAs, and the procedure would stipulate how that was going to happen, who's responsible for. So again, I think that is something that should be there.
Yeah, the thing is with organizations, a lot of cautious of, you know, death by policy and having too many documents in place. But I was talking with Joe earlier, and data protection, you know, your responsibilities under it are so broad that it's warranted more than anything. And the thing is, with something like this that affects across the organization, not just the data protection team, obviously, don't go into semantics there, Phil. You know what I mean by it. But you've got to type people in across the organization. Then it can be seen as more of a guidance point that's really useful for, you know, for people. So it's definitely warranted. And you could probably apply that to different, you know, different areas section, but it's just something that I see come up quite a lot, you know. Oh, we want to simplify it, we don't want too many documents, and that's fair enough, hard, it might not always get read, yeah. But exactly, it's needed. Yeah,
they do serve a purpose though, don't they? You know, to inform people of how to do the things that you want them to do. And I guess if you didn't have that, all it's going to do is have people just to bombard you asking questions. How do we do this? How do we do this?
Yeah.
Well, if you've got a procedure, you read the procedure and you can find out. And then if you've got any questions, you can, of course, come. Because you've got many other things to do, haven't you, other than answer questions of everyone at your organisation.
Yeah, especially if it's the same questions. Michael's point is, again, this resonates with me, you know, to a large extent, you know, some people are using you know, MS Power Apps to help, you know, pull things together. And if you can do it, if you've got the internal capability to do it, if you could build your own governance platform on your CRM system like we've done, brilliant. You know, get on and do it. You know, have you got the technical capabilities? Have you got the time? Have you got the thought process to work through the processes you want to embed in the system? But if you can do that kind of stuff, and if we can work together as a community to help each other out with this type of stuff, you know, we should be doing it, because we're all facing the same challenges. In my view. Anyway, off my soapbox. Yeah, off my rant.
We'll call it there, but thank you everyone for joining. Thank you, Phil and Joe, for joining me as well. We will be back next week with a GDPR radio session. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining.
Cheers. See you later.
Yeah, bye.